Hello and welcome back to UEG Journal Podcast, your quick dive into latest and most impactful research in gastroenterology. I'm Dr. Mohsin Subbani, Training Associate Editor of UEG Journal and Advanced HPB Endoscopy Fellow at Nottingham University Hospital, UK. We're back with the latest episode, and I am pleased to be joined by our special guest, Ms. Adele Sayers. Thank you very much for joining us, Adele.
Thank you for the introduction. So I'm actually a consultant colorectal surgeon at Sheffield Teaching Hospitals, and also obviously a lecturer at the University of Sheffield. I specialise in colon cancer, inflammatory bowel disease surgery, and also complex abdominal wall reconstruction. And yeah, no, thank you for having me. I'm here to talk about my GATA.
Great, and thank you for contributing such an high-impact guideline. So would you mind telling us, to begin with, what prompted the need to update the 2018 WHO guideline, and specifically what it means for our gastroenterology, hepatobiliary, and pancreatic surgeons?
Yeah, of course. So the original idea actually came from Gianluca Galino, who is, co-chair of the project with me. At the time, he was the guideline committee member for the European Society of Clinopatology. And there had been discussions about new studies that had been published specifically on surgical site infection prevention. And there was a discussion about how there was a need for a specific guideline on SSI prevention, focusing on intra-abdominal surgery.
Thank you. And linked to that, how significant is the burden of surgical site infection in GI surgery, and why this is such an important issue to address?
So surgical site infections are actually the most common post-operative complication that we encounter with GI surgeons. And they have a significant impact on patients. They can lead to longer stays in hospital, further complications such as wound dehiscence, incisional hernia formation. And patients can sometimes also need to go back to surgery to drain intra-abdominal infection, for example. And that's just to name a few of the complications. And understandably, all of these can really significantly impact patients' well-being and also their quality of life. In addition to this, surgical site infections have a significant burden financially on healthcare systems, and they account for about over 36% of all hospital-acquired infections. And with the actual incidence of SSIs caused by multi-drug-resistant bacteria also on the rise, which is obviously a concern. So I think given how common SSIs are within GI surgery and also the significant impact that they have, we thought this was a really crucial area that we had to address.
So this sounds like an important issue both from healthcare provider and the patient perspective. So it would be interesting to know, how did you form the working group and how the question was prioritized? Can you shed some light on that?
Yeah, so the working group was actually first put together by Gianluca after he was successful in obtaining funding for the guideline. I was then invited at that point to join the group to help with his development and became co-chair. For us, it was really important that all relevant stakeholders for the guideline were involved all the way from the beginning, which is why it's a multi-society guideline. More importantly, though, we want to ensure that patients were involved from the very, very outset to ensure that the questions that we were asking were those that were relevant to the patients. I mean, it's all well and good developing guidelines to answer questions, which us as healthcare professionals think are important. If they don't address any of the issues which patients feel important, or it includes interventions that aren't acceptable to the patients, then it kind of makes the whole guideline quite pointless in the end. So I think for us, the working group, we wanted to make sure that all the relevant people were prioritized and part of the group. And with regards to prioritization of the questions, again, you know, as you mentioned, this was an update of the 2018 WHA guideline as the basis for this guideline. And we wanted to update a lot of the key recommendations that they made within that, but make them specific to GI surgery. So based off that, the prioritization, it was obviously those recommendations. It was only worthwhile redoing the ones where we knew there was new evidence. And where we knew there was potentially going to be a bit of a change for patients who'd undergone GI surgery. The other thing that was quite important with regards to prioritization was the actual outcome setting. And this is, again, where patients seem really, really important, because, again, we want to make sure that we are addressing outcomes that are relevant to the patients. And so that's kind of how to work to that side.
Oh, excellent. So it needs a lot of work and dedication. So for a working group who wanted to do like future guidelines, can you share some challenges you faced which need to be considered from outset?
I think the biggest challenge that we had was always going to be the length of time that this body of work was going to take. And I mean, for anyone who's been involved in guidelines, you'll know this takes a long time. And it was really clear that it was going to be a massive body of work, which was going to be incredibly challenging, given that all of those who were making up the working group were full of healthcare professionals who were working full time. So this guideline is going to have to be developed in everyone's kind of home personal type. And given how broad of a topic surgical site infection prevention is, we decided that actually it was probably best to separate it and just focus on the preoperative interventions. And this is something that the WHO guideline did, is that they'd broken it down into kind of preoperative and intraoperative interventions. And so by focusing purely on the preoperative intervention, this helped kind of focus our efforts and stopped it from taking many, many, many years to develop.
Great, thank you. So now coming on to recommendations. So one key recommendation on skin preparation was evidence around alcohol-based chlorhexidine for a pre-operative skin preparation. So in context of GN, hepatobiliary surgery, what it means?
Yeah, so there were a number of RCTs that were comparing chlorhexidine and iodine. And these included comparing alcohol-based preparations, aqueous preparations, but also differing concentrations of chlorhexidine. Now, these RCTs show that when comparing these various preparations, chlorhexidine, especially the alcohol-based chlorhexidine, showed a reduction in surgical site infections when compared to all the various iodine preparations. And actually, the iodine preparations additionally caused more adverse events, such as the main one was skin irritation. So in total, there were 47 fewer infections per 1,000 patients noted when we were using alcohol-based chlorhexidine, which we felt as a guideline panel to be clinically significant.
So that's very interesting. And I think one other key question is that we got multimorbidity in our patients and a number of these patients on immunosuppression, especially corticosteroids. So what are your thoughts about preoperative management in these patients?
Yeah, I don't kind of want to go too much into the basic science at all, but it, as we know, corticosteroids, they suppress inflammation, which is obviously very crucial in the first steps of wound healing. They suppress the immune system as well. So it's not a real shock that corticosteroids can increase surgical site infections. I mean, as you can imagine, within a lot of the evidence that we had for this guideline was from patient cohorts with inflammatory bowel disease, because obviously they're a large patient group who undergo GI surgery who are on corticosteroids. But we did also include evidence as well from studies. For example, there were patients that were undergoing of GI resections, or patients were undergoing liver resections. And across the board, and when looking at all of these different studies, we found that there was a reduction in overall SSIs when stopping corticosteroids. But more importantly, there was a significant reduction in organ space infections. And organ space infections does also include, you know, anastomotic leaks. I mean, you think of those patients who have small anastomotic leaks and develop, you know, intra-abdominal collections or pelvic collections, that they come under the organ space infection group. So, yeah, so as, and that's obviously, they're at a higher risk if the corticosteroids haven't been stopped. Now, as an IBD surgeon myself, I know there's times that sometimes we can't always afford to stop corticosteroids, for example, in an emergency setting. But we do really need to carefully consider whether patients have the opportunity to be optimized before surgery. And this includes, obviously, not only making sure, you know, they are nutritionally optimized, but also includes stopping steroids. And all for those patients where it's not possible, you then need to think about what else we can do to help reduce organ space SSI. For example, not performing any anastomoses. And if we do think this could be a higher risk potentially of that anastomosis not healing and the patient developing an organ space SSI.
That's very interesting, Adil. And as a gastroenterologist, I know how important the timing and nutrition and all other aspects you mentioned in these patients. So continuing on the same topic, so any thought about anti-TNF treatment, because most of IBD patients on some sort of anti-TNF medications?
So this is a kind of more complex decision I think we need to make collectively with patients and also teens who are involved in the patient's anti-TNF medication. We found that there would be fewer overall SSIs and fewer organ space SSIs if the anti-TNFs were stopped preoperatively. But these studies are very heterogeneous, with different timings of suspension prior to surgery being one of the big factors. Overall, though, the data did show that the surgery should be planned to occur at the drug's nadir, so that's when the serum concentration at its lowest. Obviously, this would be just before the next planned infusion, meaning that a single dose would have to be missed while the patient was undergoing surgery. Now, again, I'm going to talk about this just within the context of IBD. Obviously, that can have implications on potential disease recurrence, for example, or the potential loss of response to the medication due to antibody development. So I think it's really important there needs to be a joint decision between your MDT members and also the patient as to how you best manage this. It might be, for example, for quite high-risk patients that the surgery might actually be planned for the midpoint of their treatment cycle, for example. So when the serum concentrations are on the decline rather than when they're at the highest. So say, for example, with infliximab, if a patient's on an 8-weekly regime, it might be planned around, you know, week 5 to 6, and then you still give them the infusion or then you delay the infusion by a week or two. You know, I think this is something that probably, you know, there definitely needs to be kind of joint decision making because it can be very complicated and each patient is different. So it is very difficult just to kind of, you know, give a hard, and this is what everyone should do. You know, these are recommendations that do need to obviously be discussed and also kind of tailored for each individual patients.
That's again very interesting. And I think that highlights that in this complex patient, the MDT approach and sort of what you highlighted, just not simply about stopping medication, but few other things which need to be considered. So also looking through the guideline, there were certain areas where there was a lot of uncertainty, like using aqueous chloroxidine or dexamethasone or vedolizumab. So what are your thoughts? Is purely due to lack of sufficient evidence, or is this a very hard group of patients to capture in a research setting?
I think, so there's always a desire to develop recommendations for all questions posed in the guideline. And, you know, people always want to, you know, when they develop their guideline, you know, they don't want to have to miss sections. But I felt it was really important to highlight that it's not always possible, especially if there's either insufficient evidence for guideline development, specifically when using the grade principles of how you should make the guideline. And I think for these specific recommendations, the studies either had or they had very small patient numbers, or these studies were deemed to have a critical risk of bias for the outcomes that we were investigating, and all the effects of the intervention didn't actually meet the guideline panel's predefined minimally important difference. So before we actually started looking at the evidence as a guideline panel, which again included all stakeholders and patients, we set what the minimally important clinical difference was going to be for SSIs, for adverse events. And obviously, if the evidence didn't meet that threshold, then, you know, as a guideline panel, we'd already deemed that we didn't find it wasn't clinically significant. So therefore, you know, you couldn't actually formulate a recommendation based on that.
I think the next important context in this point of view is that from your personal experience as a clinician, when we have these gray areas, so what sort of things that you think can facilitate decision making?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as I've kind of already alluded to, as with all things in healthcare, we always should be adopting shared decision-making with our patients. And it's important to inform patients that whilst, you know, there may be some evidence that continuing, you know, certain medications, for example, can increase surgical site infection risk, you know, we do need to, you know, be open and say that actually high-quality evidence on the topic is lacking. And so actually some of these results could be misleading. And it is really difficult because as with all grey areas, there's no right or wrong answer. And as I've previously said, you know, each patient will have their own concerns or their own thoughts, and it is really important to take these into account. You know, it's again just talking about, I'm going to draw on again my own personal experience with IBD. You know, if you've got patients who, for example, are having surgery for fibrotic strictures, but they are coming towards the end of the medications that they could have because they had so many either primary or secondary losses of response, you know, whether or not you are, you know, as an MDT going to stop that medication, you know, it's very different because if the evidence isn't strong to say that we should stop the medication and the patient really hasn't got many more medical options left, then obviously, you know, it would be potentially far more high risk to stop it, because if the patient does develop a secondary loss of response due to the development of antibodies, then where else has they got to go? So, you know, it's very difficult in these sort of patient groups, you know, to be able to develop these black and white recommendations, yes or no, you know, you should do this or you shouldn't do that. And that's because, you know, like as I've just said, these patients are so individual and their own kind of disease is also so individual. So I think what we can do is hopefully with this guideline, we've highlighted where some of the issues might be, you know, highlighted that from the evidence, it certainly looks like anti-TNS increase the risk of surgical site infections. And you do have to actually then have that discussion with the patient and with other MDT members and come to the decision as to whether or not how long you're going to stop it for. And it might be that, you know, they say, well, one missed dose isn't, you know, is actually going to be a huge impact for this patient. And actually, you know, the patient could have already had undergone surgery and had a significant SSI and obviously might be really concerned about that occurring again. And so in those patients, you can say, yeah, let's definitely, you know, withhold the NTNF for 1 day. You know, or there may be some other patients, you know, where it's decided actually, you know, on the balance of things, why don't we instead just aim to do your surgery, you know, when the serum concentrations, you know, on the way down. So I think it's hard when we do have these grey areas, but I think that's where the NDT and the shared decision making of the patients really kind of comes into its own. It's, you know, you can then get the opinion of, you know, your expert colleagues in helping make sometimes what can be quite tough decisions.
Okay, thanks for sharing your personal experience. So, moving on to, it's always good to have these high standard guidelines, but implementing these guidelines in clinical practice and also conveying this message with the patient. So, what are your thoughts to getting around it? Because it's always difficult to convince healthcare professional to change their practice or sort of like embrace the new evidence.
Yeah, I think for the most part, you know, there were some of these recommendations, like I said, which won't really come as a surprise to some people. I think, you know, like for example, corticosteroids, you know, I think there's a general acceptance that yes, corticosteroids, they are going to increase surgical site infections. You know, they do delay wound healing. You know, we know this. There are some things then that, you know, might be slightly more difficult. I do know, you know, within the UK, there has been a certain change to using chlorhexidine over iodine-based preparations. But, you know, it is always difficult to change practice, especially, you know, when you have, you know, clinicians who have been working, you know, for 20, 25 years who have been using the same preparation and they feel that actually it doesn't make a difference to them. And I think, as with all things in life, you know, the most important thing is communication and getting a message across. And, you know, if we just at least show what, you know, help to, or at least make it clearer what, you know, what the evidence shows, then those clinicians can look at the evidence, weigh it up themselves and decide whether or not they want to change their own clinical practice. You know, what we're developing here are guidelines, and the purpose of the guideline is to help make it easier to kind of take in all the vast amount of evidence there is out there and make it easier to appraise it, easy grade, but also to make it easier to access, you know, the basic recommendations so that people can develop, you know, their own ideas on what they want to do. And some people you'll find, you know, when there are guidelines, they say, well, the guidelines, it doesn't mean I have to do it. And absolutely not, it doesn't mean that you have to do it, but that at least it's just hoping, it's highlighting what the evidence shows so that you, again, can come to a decision, shared decision with patients on actually what the best approach is for them. And I think as well, you know, there's some questions about whether or not, because actually this is a European guideline, so actually it's going to be difficult for these to be implemented all across Europe, but the guideline panel itself was made of people from all over Europe. And certainly there was no, we didn't see there was going to be any major barriers to these guidelines based on the practices in different countries and what was available in different countries around Europe.
So to finish off, what do you see how these guidelines going to change the shape of clinical practice and how it's going to impact the patient care in the near future?
Honestly, the main thing I'm hoping for is that this guideline, you know, will have helped to highlight the aspects of care that we can change as clinicians to reduce SSI incidents in our patients. I think it's, so I'm also hoped it's helped highlight where actually that evidence is lacking. There needs to be more higher quality studies that need to be developed to help us fill in the blanks and also to help make those grey areas a little bit more black and white for us. And, you know, I think one of the things we definitely do need some high quality RCTs is specifically, as I've been talking about, looking at the rates of SSIs and immunosuppressants. You know, we've been talking about all the grey areas that are there. And I think when new studies are being developed, we also need to really carefully consider the outcomes that we're assessing. Because what I found is when we were looking at all this evidence, there was a definite lack of patient-reported outcome measures, for example, such as quality of life. And these outcomes to our patient group were involved in the guideline were actually really important. But there was no evidence about quality of life. So I think we need to carefully think about, you know, the outcomes that we are going to be assessing within our studies. And there was also very little evidence on the adverse effect of these interventions. Again, I'm going to go back to, you know, stopping immunosuppressive medication, which we've just been discussing. And, you know, there were very few studies that actually looked at the effects of stopping them. So, you know, looked at the effects of, you know, just doing that, just stopping, you know, anti-TNS, for example, for one dose, is that going to vastly increase the potential secondary loss of the swans? Is it going to vastly increase the potential recurrence of Crohn's disease, for example? So yes, I think that, you know, that was also information that we didn't really have. And there's also very few studies out there that separated out surgical site infections according to the CDC classification. So, you know, looking at superficial, deep, or organ space infection, I think that would also be very useful. Again, when coming to shared decisions. And I think not only kind of is there more scope for this evidence, RCTs, but I think there's also then scope for all the grey areas that we're just discussing, you know, and all the recommendations that we haven't been able to give an answer to, all the questions we haven't been able to formulate a recommendation for. There's also then scope for another body of work where, you know, instead it's expert opinion and a consensus statement, because this people still want some kind of help and guidance for some of these kind of very difficult conversations, you know, that they're going to have with patients. And, but, you know, the reason why we didn't develop recommendations for these questions, which is, you know, this was specifically a guideline where we've been looking at the pure, at the evidence and develop recommendations based off that. There's some recommendations where there isn't evidence there, but there is still obviously a need for a consensus-based project, a consensus statement to be developed. But that is completely different methodology to the methodology that we've been using, which is why we didn't kind of progress down that route. But yeah, you know, these are still, there's still, you know, a lot of questions that clinicians would help or want to help, you know, answering. So that's probably another, you know, there's potential scope there for another project if someone wants to go take on a consensus statement.
Thank you very much, Adele. This was a very exciting discussion, and I hope our listener would enjoy this in great details. And hopefully we'll see some more evidence from your side. And for our listener, please stay tuned for more to come from UEG Journal. And thanks for listening. And don't forget to subscribe and share.